This is a special 15th anniversary edition of Charlotte Talks from Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. I'm Mike Collins. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, there was no Charlotte Talks on WFAE, just other programming floating around in the primordial soup that congealed to become the public radio that we know and love today. At that same time, a mere 15 years ago, our guest today was crawling around in septic tanks and other disgusting and gruesome places looking for clues that would help law enforcement solve murders. And how did that start? Well, here's what she told us in 2000.
As a little kid, I would rather have, you know, cut open a frog to see how it works than to play with dolls.
And thus began the feminist movement. Not really, but that is arguably the genesis of Kathy Reich's success. She's a forensic anthropologist who, for some reason, after years of dealing with maggots and other creatures feasting on decaying flesh, thought that perhaps writing novels might be a cleaner way to make a living. She was right, and interestingly, as stomach-turning as her job may sound, there is an appetite for reading about what she has to do, because her best-selling novels, and there are 17 of them now in the Bones series, are really about her life as the kind of scientist who is willing to get dirty, really, really dirty, in her efforts to discover who done it. In the process, she has created a heroine who is also a forensic anthropologist who works both in Charlotte and Montreal, and who also finds herself in some wretched situations. Those books became the springboard for the TV show Bones. 9 years they've been going with Bones, which plays, yes. All of which plays into America's fascination with the intersection of science and crime solving, though no lab Kathy Reichs has ever worked in is as nice or as well lit as Tempe Brennan's lab on that show. Since Kathy Reich's rise to fame and success happened concurrently with the run of this program, and because she's been a frequent guest, we wanted to share the stage with her tonight at Spirit Square and bring her out of the shadows where she pounds away at her computer keyboard, writing page-turner after page-turner, and into the spotlight where we could all share our appreciation of her work and of her using Charlotte as a backdrop for many of her stories. Kathy Reichs. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Nice to be here. I'm flattered.
Well, I'm flattered that you said...
All the people you could have picked.
Well, and I'm flattered that you said yes. There was a chance that you might say no. And then where would we be tonight? I don't know. We met for the first time. I think it was Deja Dead. Was that the first book?
That was the first one.
The first time we met Temperance Brennan or talked about Temperance Brennan, who is actually your alter ego because she splits her time between Charlotte and Montreal, and she too is a forensic anthropologist. Everybody knows that. But when was that book first published?
1997.
Really?
Is that true?
No, that can't be right.
1997?
97.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why weren't you on the first year? You weren't on the first year of the show.
I've been meaning to ask you that.
You were probably too big for us to get on at the very beginning.
Uh-oh. Hardly.
And you had written technical journals and things like that. See, we're not a stranger to writing, but you'd never written fiction. Why did you, A, think you could, and B, why did you want to?
Well, I had no idea if I could. I just thought
really?
I'd give it a try. Why did I want to? I thought it would be more fun. I made full professor at the university. I was free to do whatever I wanted to do. And I had just worked on a serial murder case, and I thought it would be the good basis for a story, and that all just kind of came together, and I thought I'd give it a try.
What was your family's reaction as you sat down every couple of hours and pounded it out?
There was a lot of eye rolling going on. You know, mom's working on her novel. Yeah, they don't do that so much anymore. But
and although you had been published for your professional writings, you had never been published for fiction. And I read today that the way you got published was a boyfriend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend's mother told a woman at a publishing house that there was this book that a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend had written, and she said, all right. And she had already composed the rejection letter in her head.
Yeah, she took a few chapters home with her. It was a Friday night, already composing. We're so sorry. It's a wonderful piece of work, but it's not for us, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she read the few chapters and turned around and went back into Manhattan and got the rest of it. And I think I had an offer within 2 weeks. It is not the way to get published. You don't just mail a manuscript in unrepresented.
No.
But it worked.
But it worked for you.
It worked out.
A lot of things have worked out. When you think about it, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And quick.
That was quick. That was pretty fast, yeah. The show came about pretty quickly as well.
You have this expression of pain on your face.
Well,
why?
I feel like I should have a story of, you know, papering the walls with reject notices and deep pain for being rejected. But
does anybody ever say no?
Of course. Of course.
She doesn't, by the way. I asked her. I had to do a heart ball, something for the Heart Association, and I was asked to if I knew any famous people who would volunteer to sit at a table. And the only famous person that I knew was Kathy. And I sent her an email and asked if she would, I know I'm being presumptuous to ask this and blah, 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 but would you consider, less than 30 seconds later, yes.
I don't get out much, Mike. I don't.
So how did you come up with Temperance Brennan? How did you come up with the idea that your life could be the template for a novel and what has become a series of novels and a television show?
It just seemed easier to write about. They say write about what you know about. And so it just seemed easier to create a character based on myself, which I know something about. And I also kind of sniffed that there was this interest in forensics in the air. It was the mid-90s, and I don't know, there was this interest in the whole area. So I just thought it was a good timing for that and a good timing for a strong female heroine.
And you were right. Why do you suppose there is this interest in forensics? Because so much of science is rejected out of hand by everybody because it doesn't fit what we have in our mind, and yet we want forensic evidence at trials all of a sudden, and we want to watch it on television.
Yeah, and I don't think that was necessarily the case. I think it all started with the O.J. trial. We heard that 24/7 for how many months and months and months, and people heard about blood spatter pattern analysis and DNA and knife wound trajectories, and I have a feeling it started, because that was right about the mid-90s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of authors who write wonderful books and who are successful and write series of books who don't end up with a TV show and who don't have that TV show go on for 9 seasons. What was it about your books, your character, who this woman, Tempe Brennan, is, that made Fox TV come to you, or if I don't know whether they came to you or you went to them and said, this is a good idea. What made them think it would be a good idea?
I think they liked the combination of the female heroine. And what they wanted to do, and I think you put your finger on it in using the word character, we didn't want to just do another police procedural, another CSI type show. We wanted a character-based show where the main theme was a crime that they were going to solve, and they were going to use science to solve the crime, but that it would be a show where you would get to know and care about these characters on a weekly basis. And I think part of the success is due to how well our writers and our producers have stayed true to that idea and how well our on-screen talent has performed in their roles.
And you're listed as a producer. You don't write every show, but you have written shows. What exactly is your role as a producer? Because this is your baby. This is your character. You do have something to protect here, it seems to me.
Yeah. Once you sign your character, once you give the option to your character, you pretty much give up control. But part of the reason I went with this offer, and we'd had other ones, is that they genuinely wanted my input. So I do work on each episode. We have a staff of full-time writers. They're amazing. They come up with, we've done, I forget how many hundred episodes at this point, 22 episodes times 9 years, so you do the math. So each one of those is an original story. And I read every script, and I give them feedback, mainly on the science. And then I'm out on set as often as I can be, and then I have written some episodes as well.
In fact, you and your daughter, Carrie, who also is a fiction writer, a novelist, wrote the episode that will air on Fox Monday night.
Monday night. It's called The Dude and the Dam. And Carrie,
The Dude and the Dam?
The Dude. Everything is something and something, all of our titles. So it's The Dude in the Dam. And we had a lot of fun. Writing for television is really different from writing a novel. First of all, you do it collectively. You're not at your lonely, shadowy computer, as you said earlier. But you go into the writer's room, and you actually break the story together. You go in, and there are these terrifyingly empty, erasable boards on the walls. And for our show, they're divided into six acts, because that's how our show works. And at the end of either a week, 2 weeks, maybe even 3 weeks, you have outlined your entire episode together. You brainstorm it. And that's really a lot of fun.
Yes, but you're Kathy Reichs. It's your character. Don't you win?
Yeah, but writing television is just so different from writing a novel. It has to distill down into action. There's no description. It's all dialogue when you write television. So, and you have your A story and your B story and your C story, and you've got to wind all those together, and then you've got to incorporate your arcing stories that go from episode to episode. So there's quite a... And then you pitch it. You know, after you've done this, you pitch it, and then, you know, they tell you to change this and that, which never happens in writing a novel. And then you finally get sent to script, so you go home and you write it, and then you submit it, and then they change everything, which never happens in writing a novel. Because you have so many bosses, you have to answer to the executive producers and the studio and the network on up the hierarchy.
How difficult is that to accept? Because no one's ever said no to you before. I mean, from what I can understand here.
They said no to my opening scene on Monday's episode. I had this great idea that we were going to have this guy on an ATV, and he's going to come cruising along and hit something and go airborne and come crashing down into this puddle of slime and then find the body. You know, it's a body. Well, that got changed to a beaver. Two kids walking along in the woods. Yeah, two kids walking along in the woods, and they discover a beaver dam, and there's a body in the beaver dam. Why? Budget. You don't have to pay for an ATV crash. You don't have to pay for a stunt driver. You don't have to pay for the medics for the stunt driver. Beavers are cheap. But what we didn't know... What we didn't know is that there are only 3 working beavers in Hollywood.
I would have thought there'd be a lot more. They'll cut that out for the broadcast.
I'm talking about... So right up until shooting, we weren't sure we were going to get a beaver. But I guess there was a cancellation or something, so... So we got, and then we were told it was that this beaver, anytime you have an animal, you have to have a wrangler. We had slugs in the episode, so we had a slug wrangler and a beaver wrangler. And the beaver wrangler told us that this beaver was a bolter, that as soon as they opened the cage, it would bolt. So we're all kind of standing around waiting. Well, turns out this was a very elderly beaver, so they open it and they put it on this incredibly elaborate constructed dam that our props people had made, and we were going to release the water, and it was come rushing down, and the beaver just sat there. We had to prod the beaver with carrots to get it to... So when you see the opening scene and when you see that beaver, a lot of work went into that.
Well, I'm not sure we can top that, but we have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll try. Kathy Reichs, our guest here on the stage at Spirit Square. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
It's 9:20, and this is an archive presentation of Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, where support comes from WFAE members and Pfeiffer University, graduate and undergraduate degree programs for today's professional. Evening and online classes at the Charlotte campus begin January 6th. Details and registration at pfeiffer.edu/charlotte. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, jazz pianist Vince Guaraldi came to popularity because his is the music you hear under the Charlie Brown Peanut specials, including A Charlie Brown Christmas. But the Peanuts guy was a prolific jazz musician, pianist, and composer. We explore that side of him with local musicians and his biographer in a special Christmas edition of Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. And we're coming back to more of our discussion with Kathy Reichs. Stay with us.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the author of A History of the World in 100 Objects on the World of William Shakespeare, the director of the British Museum highlights 20 objects that illustrate life in late 16th century England.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-supported public radio, we're 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're broadcasting tonight from Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater with Kathy Reichs, a renowned author and one of the producers of and people responsible for the TV show Bones. Let me just read the list of novels. Déjà Dead, Death du Jour, Deadly Decision, Fatal Voyage, Grave Secrets, Bare Bones, Monday Morning, Crossbones, Break No Bones, Bones to Ashes, Devil Bones, 206 Bones, Spider Bones, Flash and Bones, Bones Are Forever. Tell that to Shirley Bassey. Bones of the Lost and Bones in Her Pocket. That's a lot of bones. There's more bones than in the human body, I think.
206 Bones, that's where that title came from.
You have all these books coming already out. You have a contract, because authors get a contract, and they commit themselves to writing X number of books. You've got three more in the pipeline, right? Does it scare you?
Three more of the adult books, okay. And then two more of the young adult books.
And we didn't talk about the young adult books.
Yeah.
You write books with your son.
With my son, mm-hmm.
Who, and these are based on Tempe Brennan's, what,
great niece? 14-year-old great niece, Tori Brennan. And those books are set in Charleston. And we've really had fun with those because we've introduced, and one of the main premises is that Tori and her friends, they're not cool kids at school, they really like science. So they use science at kind of a middle school, high school level to solve cold cases and mysteries. But we've also introduced an element of grounded fantasy into those books. They're not vampires or anything like that, but they have some special abilities.
So that's your son that does those books with mm-hmm. you. Then Carrie, your daughter, she writes her own series of young adult, I don't want to call them young women's books, because I've read several of them, because she's been on the show twice, so I've read her books. And I found them entertaining. But she writes that, and she helped you write this TV show. Is that the first
she
TV
and I
show
co-wrote, that she writes contemporary women's literature. It's okay. Not young adult. And she and I co-wrote The Dude in the Dam, featuring the beaver. Also featuring, this is another funny, you want to hear another funny story? That day we shot the beaver, we were filming on location, and it was a director's nightmare because we had a scene with an animal out in the woods and we had a scene with kids. It's a scene in a park and there are like 25 kids in this park. So that's like a director's worst nightmare, to do one in a day, much less two, much less out in the woods. So unbeknownst to me, my daughter Carrie signed my grandson, who's three, up to be an extra in this scene with the kids. I thought this was the worst idea ever. The kid was a star. He took direction. I have pictures of him listening to the director very solemnly. The only problem was, he's the kid on the slide. You may see him. He may have made the cutting room floor, but he's the kid on the slide. And the director said, Declan, when I yell action, you go down the slide. So Declan, Kevin would yell action, and Declan would yell action, and then go down the slide. So he may not have made it to final cuts.
they can fix that in post, don't you think?
Yeah, but he got his first check. So.
But would any of this have happened? I mean, you're an industry. You're an industry. Your family's part of the industry. Would any of this have happened if somebody hadn't said yes to that first book?
Oh, undoubtedly no.
This changed your whole life.
They'd have to make it on their own.
Oh, boy, I hope they're not listening.
Mike, what I want to know is, they're both attorneys,
yeah.
Recovering attorneys. Why they didn't figure out that they wanted to be writers before I spent $200,000 to send them to law school.
And the really neat part is that you were given an honorary doctorate in law and didn't have to spend a dime.
This is great. My husband's a lawyer. My two kids are lawyers. I was given an honorary doctorate of law, so now I'm a lawyer too.
But what if all this had never happened? Would you be happy doing what you had been doing prior to that at UNC Charlotte and also as a forensic anthropologist working in Montreal and here and for DMORT teams around the country?
Yeah, I think so. I enjoyed teaching at UNCC. I enjoyed working with the students, and I enjoyed having my feet in two worlds, you know, the forensic lab and then the academia. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I could have continued.
At one time, I've forgotten which conversation it was, but it came out that you were one of only 50 certified forensic anthropologists certified by the
American Board of Forensic Anthropology.
Thank you. Working in America. And that seems like a very small number of certified forensic anthropologists. Are there more today?
It's actually all of North America. That would include Canada. And we're up to somewhere in the 90s, I think. But some of us have died, too. So I'm not sure how many are actually practicing currently.
Why so few?
It's a rigorous process. Also, not all that many work full-time. Most of us work consulting on the side. There are some states that have official forensic anthropologists on full-time positions. Ours is not one of them. I think there's some 40 employed full-time by the military out in the lab in Hawaii, featured in the book Spider Bones, I think it was. So it's a long road to haul. You have to have a PhD and then 3 years post-PhD experience and then sit for your board exams. And
for that, you get to crawl around in septic tanks. Which you've done.
Full disclosure. The septic tanks that I had to go into were abandoned, dry septic tanks. They were not active. When I was researching that book, I called, because we had a case with a body in a septic tank, and my boss said, call and see what we need to go down in there. And this old guy said, I've been going in septic tanks for years. You don't need anything special. There's nothing in there but bacteria.
So what do you go into a septic tank wearing?
Biohazard gear, lots of it.
You're also on these FEMA DMORT teams. You're still doing this, although there's not a lot of call for that in the South. You're on the Southeastern DMORT team. A DMORT team is
Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Teams. They're federal. It's a network of federal teams activated in cases of mass fatalities at the request of locals. So they're the same as FEMA districts. Mm-hmm. So our Southeast region hasn't really had a disaster, thank God.
Yeah, but you were called in because I think all the DMORT teams in the country were called in after 9/11.
Yeah, we didn't really go in as teams. We went in as individuals, anybody that could get there because it was so hard to get anywhere.
Because the planes weren't flying, but you went to New York as part of that. Were you at Ground Zero, or were you, they took a lot of the debris to landfills over time.
Both.
Where were you?
Yeah, both. Initially, I was at Ground Zero, and then I was most of my deployment out at the Staten Island landfill.
This is something that we probably are unaware of, that most of us never heard anything about this on the news, and gosh knows they covered that story forever and to a fare thee well, but I'm not sure we knew much about people like you going in to identify remains. How do you deal with something like that?
Well, that was a little easier because they did provide support. There were FBI psychologists and there were priests and preachers, you know, wandering through. They'd come in and just casually to have conversation, but the whole time they're looking deeply into your eyes, you know, to see how you're doing. That's not true when you're just doing a per case basis. You don't have any support like that. So, and then you were briefed in and briefed out. So, the psychologist told you what kinds of impact it might have psychologically, dreams and sleeplessness and that kind of thing.
And did it?
You know, when I was debriefed, I thought, pooey, not me. I did have some of those.
Because you deal with mostly bones, hence the names of the books. You're not one of those people that necessarily has to deal with physical remains because that goes to a different kind of person, right?
Well, no. I deal with decomposed or mummified or boned or, burned or dismembered, or any time that a pathologist can't do a normal autopsy, then I might work on those kinds of cases, reducing the tissue down to bone so that we can get what information we can.
So I will ask you the same question I've asked proctologists. Why? What makes you come to work every day?
Well, somebody's got to do it. And my patients, unlike the proctologist, do not complain.
Also, in an earlier conversation, you said that despite the fact that people know who you are and that you're very much in demand as a forensic anthropologist, and you're splitting your time between these two different countries, North Carolina does not make great use, or did not make great use, of people who do what it is that you do, and that they could benefit from that. And I think news events over the last year or so, when they've been throwing cases out for lack of qualified evidence, right, maybe they've learned their lesson, have they, or are they still not using forensic anthropology?
It's not just forensic anthropology. We had a major scandal in our forensics lab here, primarily involving the blood spatter and serology, that mm-hmm. section. But supposedly it is lack of funding by the legislature. And I think there was just another story in the news today or within this past week about how little we pay the scientists at our lab, and therefore we can't keep good people or have enough people.
But they won't even call people in when they need them?
Well, they will if you'll work for free. But
how many states are like that?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
I don't know. I know a lot of my colleagues in other states have much better arrangements.
Hmm. I spoke with another professor at UNC Charlotte who has nothing to do with forensic anthropology. They're actually in the marketing department. But he's read all of your novels, and he pointed out that in the novel Devil Bones, I'll jog your memory.
Yeah, you're going to have to. It's five books back.
You wrote a character by the name of Jennifer Roberts.
Okay.
Who in the book is a witch. Now, as our audience obviously knows from the reaction, Jennifer Roberts was the chairwoman of the Mecklenburg County Commission.
She brought this up to me. We were standing in line somewhere. I forget where, but we were standing in line somewhere, and Jennifer Roberts was right behind me. The reason I use that name is I donate each year to the American Heart Association an auction item that, if you are the winner, you purchase this auction item. It is that I will use your name in a book as a character. And that year, that item was purchased by her father, by a young lady named Jennifer Roberts. So it had nothing to do.
So there are no legal ramifications of that? The fact that somebody buys that gives you permission to do that? Because I know the TV is very careful about character names.
Oh, every single name has to be vetted, yeah. When I wrote an episode in season 5, my neighbors thought it would be fun to use all of their names, so I did that. And only about half of them made it through. One of whom is a witch. One of whom is my neighbor, Sherry Bird, who ended up also being a witch. The episode was called The Witch in the Wardrobe.
Hmm.
A dead witch. But, I'm not sure she was thrilled, but...
have other people made it in, even though they haven't been part of this auction to become a character?
I really limit it to that because unless I do something for fun, like using my neighbors or...
Where do the names come from? You just open the phone book?
That's one of my favorite things, is making up names. No, I don't open the phone book. Okay. I often open the obituaries, and I'll use one last name, and then I'll go to a different edition and use a first name and put them together and make a new name, because then I know I've got a regionally appropriate name. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm setting a story in Charleston or here in Montreal, I want to make sure I'm using a name that's regionally realistic.
How many people in the audience have read her books or a book? I want to point out that some of you raised your hands, and that will not be on the radio.
Plus, we can't see them out there.
Well, one of the neat things from a Charlottean's perspective is when the story is set, at least partially sometimes, in Charlotte, because of the references to local landmarks. In the latest book, Bones of the Lost, there's a lot of time spent on Old Pineville Road near Roundtree Road and the elevated Lynx tracks. And you go into great detail on the surroundings where this young woman in the book has lost her life. And I did not, I was going to go down Old Pineville Road and stop and check it out and see if it was exactly the same. And I didn't, but it seemed very familiar.
I did. I drove that whole area. I took pictures. I have them on my cell phone if you want to see them.
No, I trust you. Do you find that easier than just making it up?
Easier. Well, I use real place. Yes. In my books, wherever I set it, whether it's Guatemala or Charleston or here or Montreal, I use real place. I use, unless I'm going to have a murder scene, I won't set a murder scene in a restaurant or something like that, because they might not be pleased with that. But I do use, actual real places, streets and neighborhoods. And
place is important?
I think so, yeah. Places, I use very detailed descriptions of place, so... this one includes, both Charlotte and Afghanistan.
Yes. So. Can you see to read?
No.
Okay, then I'll read it for you, because I can see to read. Because this reads like the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce wrote it. Chapter 14. South End, just below Uptown Charlotte, is a mixed hunk of turf with serious ambitions up the social ladder and climbing fast. The neighborhood dates back to the 1850s, when the construction of a railroad line connected the Queen City to Columbia and Charleston. Over the decades, a manufacturing community sprang up along the tracks, fired largely by a booming textile industry. Fast forward to the waning years of the 20th century, largely ignored by a town viewing itself as the face of the new South. South End had little to offer beyond abandoned mills, warehouses, and a minor league baseball park. But come the 90s, KG developers saw dollar signs. Today, South End is a melange of condos, lofts, and renovated industrial leftovers, housing restaurants, shops, studios, and a broad spectrum of design-related industries. Want a plumbing fixture? Fabric? Upscale lamp? South End is the answer to your needs. How much did they pay you?
It's true. That's how I view it.
Do readers who have never been here, do they enjoy that aspect of these books?
I've been told by any number of readers that they've come here and done a tour, or Montreal, and they've done a tour going to places that Temperance Brennan has mentioned in her books.
I did that in Savannah for the Midnight and the Garden of Good and Evil. Yes, people do that. Who knew? I thought it was odd. We have to take a break. We'll come back from Spirit Square with more of our conversation with Kathy Reichs on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Common Market, offering fresh deli sandwiches, craft beer, an extensive wine selection, and urban provisions. Open early, open late, 365 days a year. Locations in Plaza Midwood and South End. Coming up at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, the author of A History of the World in 100 Objects talks with Diane about his newest work of historical reconstruction. In it, he presents 20 objects that illustrate the dynamic period in late 16th century England that produced William Shakespeare. That's coming up at 10. It's not too late to support public radio and WFAE in 2013 with a tax-deductible contribution before December 31st. We fell a little short of our $100,000 goal during our one-day December drive, but you can help fill the void and really make your contribution count by calling 704-549-9000 or by pledging online at WFAE.org. And thank you.
Hi, this is Amy Rogers from WFA Eats, the food blog, where we share stories about food and recipes for you to try on family and friends. As we look to a new year, you can pick up some new ideas and recipes to spice up your celebrations at WFAEats.org and also by listening to The Splendid Table and America's Test Kitchen, weekend afternoons at 3 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're broadcasting from Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater because it's our 15th anniversary broadcast. I have been aging as I sit here, I know that. Our 50th anniversary broadcast, and Kathy Rikes, well-known author and a producer of TV's Bones and a forensic anthropologist, graciously said yes when we said, would you, could you, maybe grace us with your presence, and she has, and we're grateful for that. The other major settings that appear quite frequently in your novels, that would be Montreal, Quebec. Not to be disrespectful to Charlotte, but Montreal is probably a more interesting romantic setting to most of your readers than Charlotte, North Carolina is. I mean, many people have probably never even heard of Charlotte before.
Well, they have now.
Well, they have now, but they didn't originally. It was the publisher's reaction originally. You can't put the book there.
You know, I was so naive when I wrote the first book. I thought Montreal's this wonderful city. It's a little bit exotic, but close enough to be familiar and comfortable for American reading audiences. It wasn't until after Scribner bought the book that my editor said to me, well, when we heard it was a Canadian setting, we're pretty sure we'd ask you to change that. And then she said, we read the manuscript, and we said, no, we'll keep it in Montreal. So did that answer your question?
No, but that's okay.
So there is this idea, there was this idea in publishing that Canadian settings do not sell well in the United States, but that did not prove to be the case.
I enjoyed those first couple of books because it was the only time since high school I've been able to practice my high school French, both reading it and talking about it on the radio. Your husband, Paul, is actually here tonight. I don't know where he is, but he's here there he is, right there, Paul Rikes. You may want to leave the room for the next few minutes, Paul. Because Tempe Brennan, her alter ego, has not been as fortunate as Kathy has because she's been through a husband, and he's gone. But you write a lot about Tempe's personal life and her struggles, and one of the things that you write about is sex. And go ahead. No, but you write about sex, and I'm just wondering what the reaction of the family is and the friends are and how you regard this, because...
Okay, first of all, I've been accused of having no sex in my books by my friends. Now, my son said he stopped reading my books after the second or third one or something because there was a scene on a boat with panties being involved or something. So I get mixed reactions.
You get mixed reactions. Yeah. Do you find it difficult to write about that? Because people think you're writing about you because she does what you do.
It's cutaway sex, though. I mean, you know, cutaway where you go right up to and then end of chapter.
I could pursue this, but we're on the radio. We'll do it. We'll save it for the... We'll save it for the after party, the after show here, I guess. What's your attitude about her? Is it like looking into a mirror for you? Is she like a daughter to you? Is she like a girlfriend to you? What is Tempe to you?
Well, I think of her kind of as an alter ego, although she does, more so in the early books, I'd get annoyed because she does some incredibly stupid things. She goes off on her own and interrogates witnesses, and she, you know, digs up bodies.
She wouldn't do that if you didn't put her up to it.
Well, it's true. But she doesn't do that in later books.
Right. She's getting smarter because she's getting older and more experienced?
Yeah, I think so. Or just older, maybe. I don't know.
And the TV Tempe. The TV Tempe is younger than the book Tempe. She's prior to the books, right?
Yes, I think of it as a prequel. It's like Tempe, the early years.
So is she more reckless than... The book Tempe?
She's more involved in the investigative end of it than I am, realistically. She goes off with the cop with Seeley Booth and interviews witnesses and goes to, well, I go to crime scenes, but she does things that a normal forensic scientist wouldn't do. I would maybe go to a crime scene and then work in the crime lab, maybe testify in court, but I don't go off, talking to families or pursuing suspects or any of that.
Of course, it would be a pretty dull book if she didn't get into trouble and
exactly.
and go out on her own and go into some of these situations that provide drama. And you obviously don't do that, but she's constantly in danger in the book. She's in danger several times through a series of a book. Have you ever been in danger? Have you ever been threatened as she is in these books sometimes?
I've been threatened. I was testifying in a trial once, and the prosecutor sent me upstairs. He said there's a problem, and I thought it was, some legal thing that lawyers argue about. And he came and got me, and he said, well, the defendant says he's going to kill you. And they said, we can't bring cops into the courtroom because it's prejudicial. So if he comes at you, stay in the witness box. And I immediately had a plan that if he came at me, I was going to dive behind the judge. So, and also when I went to testify at the United Nations Tribunal on Genocide in Rwanda, that was under witness protection, so that was a little dicey. And in Guatemala, it was still, there were those that were not happy with the investigation into the death of a lot of the people that died during the Civil War there. So we were not allowed to wander around freely. But no, I don't have people that hit me over the head and zip me into hockey bags and, lock me in morgue coolers and things that happen to Tempe.
Here's something I've also wondered about, because she doesn't eat well, Tempe. She is constantly filling the void with Diet Coke, and Dale Halton from Pepsi's here tonight, so I apologize for that. But she's finally filling the void with that and with power bars and in Bones of the Lost. At one point in the book, she opens the refrigerator after a very long day to find a frozen burrito and a couple of frost-covered pot pies. And she goes for the pot pies. Please, God, tell me you eat better than she does.
If I'm home alone and there's nobody else to cook for and there's no food in the house, it can be pretty grim. When I go off on tour, I will have been gone 2 weeks, and I will have been in very fine restaurants and hotels, and then I get home, and all of a sudden, I might be eating a peanut butter sandwich. It can often be not very pretty.
She forgets to eat because she's so involved in the cases, and her time is taken up doing research. She can never get the case out of her mind. Was that the case for you when you were doing this actively all the time?
I'm more like that with writing. I try to get at it any day I have a free day to write, because I don't have the luxury of being a full-time writer. I try to get at it by 8:30 or so.
You're not a full-time writer?
Well, I mean, I have to go off and do other things. I go off on tour and I go to the lab, or I go out to Los Angeles to work on the show. So I have lots of interruptions. I don't have an uninterrupted block of time to write a book. So anytime I'm free at home, I write all day. And I will probably write until it might be 2 o'clock when I look at the time and realize I haven't eaten anything. So that happens with me more when I really get engrossed in writing.
Hmm. What is your routine for that when you're home and available to do it?
Well, that's it. I'll make coffee. I'll try to stick with writing. Probably it'll be 1:30 or 2, and then I'll go eat some lunch and then go back at it.
Because I know that at least when you're facing a deadline, you have to write. You got to get it done. And I know that you have this beach house that you have taken the family to. You bought the house so that the family would be there and congregate.
Right.
They're out on the beach, on the deck, having fun. You're in the writer's room, looking out the window going,
Yeah, I have a big bay window in my master bedroom on the second floor, and it looks right out on the beach, and there they are out there frolicking with all their sunblock, and I'm up at the keyboard looking pasty.
This new book, and you mentioned this a second ago, Bones of the Lost, part of the book takes place in Afghanistan, and in fact, your Tempe's daughter is based. She's enlisted in the Marines or the Army.
Army.
And she's gone off to Afghanistan, and you go for a different reason. Tempe goes for a different reason. But you've actually been to Afghanistan. You went there as a part of a USO tour, correct?
Yeah. November, a year ago, I guess. five authors were invited by the USO, Clive Cussler and Sandra Brown and Mark Bowden and Andrew Peterson. So the five of us went, just a very small group, and we met to thank our service persons for their being there, for going over. And it was a real experience flying around in Black. We spent a lot of time flying in Black Hawk helicopters. And
you were in the copter with the guy who wrote Black Hawk Down.
Yeah, Mark Bowden, who wrote Black Hawk Down. So every now and then I'd go, "We good? We okay here?" You know. Yeah, so we spent a lot of time just going out to forward operating bases wearing 40 pounds of body armor and helmets, and it was quite an experience. But we went to thank the troops, and they spent their whole time thanking us for coming, so it was really quite a moving experience.
And you met one young guy who it's difficult for him to talk to his wife at home about things because she doesn't understand, and he's out of that life, and what they talk about is your books. That's what they have in common.
For the show. Mm-hmm.
It's pretty amazing.
He thanked me for having given him this common ground that they could talk about sort of out of time, out of space. It's something they both watched on both ends.
I'm taking that the description that you have of where Tempe spent the night at the Bagram Air Force Base is common to your experience of going there. Mm-hmm. Here's what, and I guess this is the common quarters that are there for the men and women who are serving, is that right?
These are kind of upscale quarters.
Here's the description. My quarters consisted of one half of a bee hut, a plywood box in a maze of identical boxes, all squatting in a field of kiwi-sized gravel. The interior might be 8x10, contained two bunks, two slapped-together nightstands, a wooden wardrobe filled with shrink-wrapped cases of bottled water, and a table heaped with dusty magazines and ancient copies of Stars and Stripes, and miraculously, a PC terminal that looked 20 years old. How long would you want to stay in a place like that?
How long do you want to stay? That's why we went over to thank the troops. Nobody wants to stay in that. Sandra Brown was my roommate, and We stopped in Kyrgyzstan. We went both to Kyrgyzstan and Afghanistan. And our first night in Kyrgyzstan, we stayed in kind of a dormitory women's quarters. And we thought it was a real hardship because the bathroom was way down the hall. Well, we get to Bagram. The bathroom is like a football field away outside. So we figured out this system of, you know, right away we think, okay, middle of the night, what do we do? Because inevitably, we're going to need to go up there. So we had our boots, and we had our helmets, and we had our flashlight, and we had it all set up. And we vowed that if one had to go, the other would go with.
Uh-huh. And Tempe vows not to go the book. The other inspiration, that's one of the inspirations, the fact that you went to Afghanistan. The other inspiration, because there's an element of this story in Bones of the Lost, about human trafficking. That's the dead girl. I didn't know this, but your daughter, one of your daughters, is a nurse?
Yeah, she's here somewhere. Courtney's out there. And she's worked alongside sexual assault victim nurses and is involved in some organizations that work to help victims of human trafficking. Mm.
Is a lot of that going on?
North Carolina is one of the top six states or something. We're way up there for human trafficking. So she encouraged me for many years to use that as a topic, and I finally got tired of her nagging. And so I decided to address that in this book.
You're also a professional juggler. People don't know this, but it's true, because you crank out these books, book after book after book. You're touring the world with your books. You're writing the TV show. You're a producer. You're a forensic anthropologist. You're a mom. You're a wife. You're a professor, although not often anymore. How do you do it, and are you exhausted? Does your brain get tired after a
while? Yeah, yeah. It takes organization. It takes discipline. Yeah, you get tired of that. You just want to go out on the beach and put some sunblock on, you know, and kick back.
Well, surely you could stop if you wanted.
I'm under contract for two. I'm currently writing one. It'll be out next year in August. It's called Bones Never Lie. So I'm writing that one, and then I'm under contract for two more after that.
And you're changing publishers.
I just changed publishers, The Unthinkable. Yeah. So this is the first book that I'll be doing with Random House instead of Scribner.
So that means new editors, new people to talk to, new people to work with. Does that matter to you, really?
Yeah, it matters a lot. To have a good publisher, a good publicist, a good editor is really critical. And I've met them. They're lovely people. We all got naked and went to a spa together. But I don't...
Let's get back to the sex.
Actually, we went to the spa together and then got naked. So, technically.
Whatever you say. If this all stopped tomorrow, would you miss it?
You know, I probably would. I whine, like most authors do, about having to go on tour and having to schlep from city to city to city. But I think, you know, and then you get home and you walk out to the car and you stand there waiting for someone to open the door. Nobody does. So I do. I think I would miss it, but I think the pace maybe is just a bit much right now.
Bones of the Lost is the latest in the series of books. The next book, you also have a book, a short story book that followed this very
quickly. It's not a short story book. I wrote my first digital short story for download only. It's called Bones in Her Pocket.
Okay.
And that's set here in Charlotte. And yeah, and I'm working on a new one of those.
And Monday night, November the 11th on Fox TV, Kathy and her daughter Carrie have written the episode of Bones that will air that night. Thank you so much for the hour, and thank you for being such a frequent guest and such a treasure to Charlotte. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.